I know he had promoted that yesterday, but he was on a little earlier this morning in the at the top of the 7 o'clock hour. So if you missed that conversation talking about tax conformity efforts, the bill that passed in the House, what they're working on in the Senate, and so forth, download the iHeartRadio app, subscribe to the Justice and Drew channel, just pull up hour two of today's program, and you can hear that conversation with Paul Gazelka.
Jason Flores, Americans for Prosperity, joins us in studio every year. The legislature has to change the tax code to bring the state and the tax system in alignment with federal law, an annual exercise known around the state capitol as conformity. This year, after the biggest federal tax overhaul in decades, Minnesotans would face significant consequences if the legislature does nothing. The House passed their version, 90-38, backing this particular plan. Simplicity in the tax code, historic tax relief, focusing on the middle class. That's what the bill does, said Representative Greg Davids, the bill's author and the chair of the House Taxes Committee. 13 DFL lawmakers joined every Republican in support of the House plan. We talked with Senate Majority Leader Paul Gazelka, as Drew said earlier in the show. Right around 10:15, the Senate will release their version. So we've been kind of working through what some of those changes might be. One thing we hadn't touched upon yet in this Star Tribune article, Dayton signaled resistance to some of the measures of the House tax proposal, including the long-term impact on the state's finances and the division of spoils between families and corporations, whose rate would go down under the House plan from 9.8 to 9.64. Oh, so generous. And then to a 9.06 in 2020. Oh,
the state's going to be bankrupt.
Can we? Yeah, oh, I mean, seriously. We're down. We're intense. Here, I mean, I know as we talked about the box they're in. Do you think that? I wonder if the Senate version will have changes to that to make Dayton happy.
Well, I think there's generally been pretty broad agreement between the governor and House and Senate leadership on what to do on the corporate side, because that's I think it can be cleaner. Some of the full expensing, reducing those rates, the conformity with the good things that happened at the federal level for businesses, for small businesses, for pass through income. That's something broadly agreed upon. Never mind the rhetoric on the House floor yesterday. And remember that oftentimes the rhetoric wasn't matching up with the vote that they took in, sure, in the end, as quite a few legislators did cross party lines. But I think the governor, he wants to have this rhetoric of we can just tax corporations or we can tax businesses and we can suck all this money out. And yet he's not even listening to his own administration. The Department of Revenue publishes every year a tax incident study, which talks about, all right, what's the actual impact? If the state taxes a corporation, what's the impact? If you tax property, if you tax sales tax, how does that then filter down to what's its impact on an individual? And they've published for years, decades, the governors have plenty of time to read it, that those kind of corporate taxes, those kind of corporate taxes get passed down. The vast majority, the overwhelming majority of that corporate tax gets passed down to consumers, and yet he always proposes it. He always complains about the breaks. Look, if you aren't making your business tax climate competitive with the rest of the nation, and Minnesota absolutely isn't, you're going to see weak economic growth, you're going to see weak job growth, and that's exactly what we've seen for the course of Governor Dayton's administration.
You guys have certainly dealt with Dayton much longer than I have, and so provide a little bit of insight. When it comes to Dayton and its decision-making process, how much of this is Dayton, and how much of this is people around Dayton and DFL? I mean, in terms of his brand of leadership, I mean, I kind of got my own snapshot in the 2 years that I've dealt with him, but I'm curious for you guys that have been dealing with him for much longer, your perspective on him as a person and leader.
Deep breath. Erratic. I think you saw, I mean, you've seen in the last... Oh, sorry.
Erratic and unpredictable.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. You've seen the last couple of years where, even last year, where he signs a tax bill,
right,
you know, with a Republican majority, kind of the new reality of, look, this is what your policies of 2013 and 14 got you. The state decided, nope, we can't handle more of that. We need to go the other direction. So as you have conservatives in the legislature now, he signs a tax bill and changes his mind hours later, partly due to pressure from the outside. So he is influenceable that way, but when you are dealing with or negotiating with somebody in an end of session framework like you're going to this year, that is that erratic.
Yeah,
it gets very hard to craft a bill with what he's going to do in mind. The House and Senate, I think they just need to do the best thing for the state of Minnesota and then go out and sell it and put pressure on the governor to say, no, these tax decreases for individuals and for businesses are good for the state. They can free the state from the economic doldrums that your policies have put them in. And yeah. Allow voters to make their minds up.
I think he's got a very distorted view of the role that government plays in people's lives. I think he far overvalues the role that government plays and how important yes. government is to the well-being of the state. He's, when I say he's erratic, he's had a history of shifting priorities, of saying one thing at the beginning of a legislative session as being his priority.
One thing at the beginning of the end of session negotiation as yeah. to the end of it. So.
Yeah. So, you know, he'll say one thing to the legislature, but then he'll get back to his office and either he'll change his mind or someone on his staff or, you know, some public sector union will get to him and all of a sudden he'll, you know, I mean, how many times has his staff had to walk back, you know, statements that he's made over the course of his administration?
It reminds me, it almost seems like we need to get him a Twitter account because it reminds me of what the president does. It reminds me of what the president does when he goes and he tweets something. And then it ends up having to be clarified and to back it up. You know, he sort of like you get this initial impression, his instinctive reaction to something. He tweets it out. Yeah. And then we get the reality of what ends up happening. In Dayton's case, he doesn't benefit from using Twitter to sort of get his instinctive reaction out there. He just does it and then has to pull back later on or has to be corrected later on.
Yeah, that instinctive reaction sometimes gets signed into law.
Right.
The biggest thing with the governor here at the end of this session is he's trying to, or he's at least talked about focusing on what that legacy of his might be. And unfortunately for the state, it's just more taxes and more spending. And in many ways, an incompetent administration when it comes to using those investments that Minnesota tried to make. You're trying to make investments in transportation. It's going to boondoggle transit projects. You try to make investments even in a licensing system that doesn't work, in a Minsure website that doesn't work, in the expansion of the Medicaid programs under Obamacare that Governor Dayton brought. He's not concerned with $30 million of uncollected premiums, never mind that it was his administration that couldn't collect it, and their fault they weren't collected in the first place. He's not concerned with waste, fraud, and abuse within Medicaid, even though the Office of the Legislative Auditor says it's hundreds of millions of dollars in a biennium that we're leaving on the table in fraudulent or just non-eligible payments. This is his legacy of a bigger and more bloated state government that is doing a worse and worse job actually providing for the people of Minnesota.
Talking with Jason Flores, Americans for Prosperity, talk a little bit about the governor and the provider tax and what's happening with that.
Well, this is the break that we're talking about a little bit with reality, where the governor says that his tax plan is tax relief for all Minnesotans, and yet in the same budget he increases the provider tax by $1 billion a year. Currently it's set to expire, and he wants to reinstate it, which according to him isn't a tax increase. I don't know what the definition of is anymore, but it's a tax increase. Let's leave it there. And again, this tax increase on a provider tax, otherwise known as a sick tax, every time that you go to the doctor, you're paying more. I thought we were in the business of getting government out of the way of creating government-imposed costs in healthcare. And I think the House and Senate have done a very good job pushing back on that, messaging on that, talking about how regressive it is so that it hits the poorest folks in Minnesota the most, and how we shouldn't be adding to those costs. And yet, to our point about, you know, changing mind and priorities and a little bit of hypocrisy before, at the same time, you got the Senate Finance Committee today considering an amendment to raise taxes on prescription drugs to pay for an opioid epidemic or some kind of government response opioid epidemic. And it's not just because you have good intentions, just because you want to help. That is not justification for a tax increase, especially not when you have surpluses like we have, especially not when you have a budget surplus like we have. Look, if there is a government response to the opioid epidemic, then let's talk about it. But that's a priority we can all share out of the general fund. Then we should be funding something that does that, or using federal funds, or using funds that are available in the private sector from many of the very companies involved in this that are putting resources into addressing the problem. But raising a taxes on people who already can't afford their health care in order to pay for a new government program, it's simply ridiculous. And the fact that the Senate Republican caucus is considering that at the same time, as I know they understand what taxes do to the people, it that kind of blows my mind.
And it infuriates me that they want to effectively punish and charge the people that are presumably, for the most part, using these drugs responsibly, using them the way that they are supposed to be used, right, or using them to deal with chronic pain. They're the ones that are now responsible for paying for those that have abused it.
Well, and it misses the point that so much of the opioid epidemic is also completely outside of the prescription drug system. It's even outside of the abuse, right, of leftover prescription drugs. It's, right, flat out counterfeit synthetic crap that's being brought in and trafficked here.
Right.
That's also in that opioid category. So we have to, there are many good things that the legislature is proposing to deal with the opioid epidemic, in limiting prescription length, limiting the amount of time you have to fill that prescription so that people aren't filling grandma's unused prescription a year later or something like that. And we also have to crack down on the actual criminal element of this, right? But raising taxes on law-abiding citizens that are just trying to get medication to deal with their health struggles, that's not the way to do it.
Well, and leadership, regardless of party affiliation, needs to be brave enough to look at this particular issue, and in this case, when it comes to this opioid epidemic, and say, look, there's some things that we can't just throw sort of a blanket fix on.
Right.
This requires a much lengthier examination. It's going to take a long time to fix, and we can't go the route. And I'm going to sort of reiterate what you've been saying, Jason, but we can't just go the route of saying, well, we're going to pull all this money from this particular place, even apart from what it does for individuals that need it, you know, charging them more. We need to be able to say, no, this is not something that we can immediately just go and tax our way to a fix. It's going to require lengthier discussions of how we go and address it. And they need to be brave enough to be able to look to the voter and trust the voter is going to understand them being rational about the issue.
Right. Just putting a $20 million or a $40 million price tag on a flyer and being able to say, I spent this money on the opioid epidemic. Right. I don't know that a voter looks at that and says, oh, that fixed it. I mean, look at all the money we've spent in the state on so many other concerns, and it just, that money alone hasn't done the trick.
Right, right. And it speaks to the, we won't get into it now, it speaks to the broader issue of what to do about healthcare and getting the government out of healthcare. I went through a situation last week. I was on the precipice of having to spend personally thousands upon thousands of dollars of unnecessary testing that would have been much more than that when it comes to the insurance costs of it, just because of that lack of a one-on-one personal relationship with a doctor. And it's something that a lot of people don't experience. But when you do, and you see the dollar amounts ticking just because there was a difference of opinion between two different individuals that could have been completely fixed if I had had a better relationship with the doctor. Not all of that is government involved, but it is to say that there's so much money that just gets wasted within the healthcare industry than not accounted for, that putting the government more involved in that particular thing is not the solution by any stretch.
We've seen that proven over and over again since and even before Obamacare.
Yep.
It feels like this is that the healthcare debate and healthcare conversation isn't necessarily going to be a prominent one in the upcoming governor's race. It doesn't feel like it so far, but it needs to be.
Yeah, it needs to continue to be. I think part of that is because the House and the Senate, through their reinsurance bill that was passed last year, they kind of coated over and put a Band-Aid on the problem until after the election, truthfully. So it is going to be a problem, an ongoing problem, after the election, and we should be talking about it.
Yeah.
And we should be talking about it in, look, I'm the first to say I've given this president and the Congress a lot of grief for not doing more to roll back Obamacare. They should have. They had a clear mandate to do it. They didn't. And yet, it's not just that simple either. You know, one bill of the federal government isn't going to fix this healthcare problem. And at the bottom of it, I think the best thing to do is give control back to states like Minnesota to make our own decisions so we can have that robust debate here. Because guess what? Pre-Obamacare, we had a pretty good thing going for us here. We were making the right choices. And I trust the people of Minnesota to make choices about healthcare much more than I trust 435 people in Congress.
That's what was so... It was so... When you go back to the debate over Obamacare, I just want to bang my head against the desk because they were... Those that were pushing it, and just to deviate for a second, but those that were pushing Obamacare did such a good job of vilifying and demonizing the current, what we had back then in terms of healthcare and providership.
Right.
They did such a good job of casting it as a villain, this broken thing. And look, there were things that needed to be fixed, but it wasn't broken by, I would give anything to go back pre-Obamacare to what we had and be able to work with that to try to make corrections.
And especially in Minnesota. I mean, you had literally one of the nation's leading healthcare systems, right. both government and private here in Minnesota prior to Obamacare. And Governor Dayton's decision to bring Obamacare, implement that here in Minnesota, all it did was drag Minnesota down to this lowest common denominator where, yeah, states that were really poor before are maybe 10% better-ish. But they're judging that based on insurance coverage, which, yeah, more people might be covered now than in 2008, but they have insurance they can't use. They have one option for a provider. They have a deductible that's through the roof. They're dependent on government payments, which are now sucking up a third of Minnesota's entire state budget. It's simply not sustainable in the long run. Probably shouldn't go down this rabbit hole or I'll be here forever.
Well, and look, one more quick point on that. I'm shooting from the hip on this one, but when it comes to the opioid crisis, you know, how much has that been exacerbated? Because of the changes that were made, right? How much of that has contributed to that problem that we have? It might be small, but even if it's small, it still makes a difference.
Yeah, if you've got people that are turning to opioids to deal with problems that they otherwise might not be able to afford.
Right.
If opioids are proving to be a cheaper alternative to cope with whatever they're dealing with, then going through their doctor and going through the medical procedures because they have become unaffordable thanks to the Affordable Care Act, there might be something there. Yeah. I don't know.
Well, let's not forget that we're now in a situation where 1 in 5 Minnesotans is on a government healthcare program. 1 in 5 Minnesotans is on a government healthcare program. That means that any of these taxes that you put in place, a provider tax or an opioid tax, that's also paid for by state programs. So we are taxing ourselves 1 out of 5 times and just paying more.
Well, and I'll spin back to
that
my
personal. Rate is way too high. 1 out of 5.
Yeah, and I'll spin back to my personal example. The only reason why I didn't end up spending all that money that I did last week for testing that was not necessary was because I stayed on top of it.
Right.
Because I went and I said, no, I'm not leaving here until I talk to my person to find out what is exactly going on. And I imagine for most people, especially for those on the government programs, they're just like, okay, we'll go ahead and get this test just to be sure. You know, we'll go ahead and get it taken care of. I mean, money just gets wasted.
Jason Flores from Americans for Prosperity. You can find out more at AmericansForProsperity.org.
Yeah, visit our website, AmericansForProsperity.org. Also, if you want to influence this legislative session, you can sign up there to get our action alerts, to take action. Give me 30 seconds on our website on a variety of topics from tax conformity to healthcare costs and everything else. Contact your legislators. This last 3 weeks of the session is critical that they hear from you. Otherwise, you're hearing from industry lobbyists, they're hearing from union lobbyists, they're hearing from everybody that's not you. So you have to make your voice heard, especially in these last 3 weeks.
Yeah, people really underestimate how important it is to be heard, to contact, because, you know, I guarantee you the people on the other side of the issue, that whatever issue that you're right. you're passionate about, there are people talking to your legislator that are on the other side of it.
And it doesn't have to be complicated. It doesn't have to be in-depth. You don't need all the details. Just call up your legislator and say, hey, I need this tax relief. Thank you for providing this tax relief. Yep. It's that simple.
Follow on Twitter at ProsperityMN. Thank you for coming in, man.
Always Absolutely. Always happy to be here, guys.
Pete Hegseth, just after 8:30. Next, feds shouldn't interfere with the Metropolitan Council. That's according to the editorial board at the Star Tribune.
Your shot at $1,000 now. Text the keyword cash to 200-200. You'll get a text confirming entry plus iHeartRadio info. Standard data and message rates apply. That's cash to 200-200.
Hey, it's John Justice and Drew, here to talk about Weider Artery Health. Now, I've had my
1-989-5855 is the phone number, or you can use the hashtag TCNT on Twitter if you want to communicate with the show at any time. Just got done talking with Jason Flores from Americans for Prosperity, and we're getting looking forward to being joined by Pete Hegseth in about 10 minutes or so.
Yeah, we got lots to cover with Pete, including the future of the appointment to head the VA. Since the most recent choice in Ronnie Jackson has withdrawn, and we'll get his thoughts on the situation when it comes to Israel and Iran, and Benjamin Netanyahu coming out and saying that Iran lied about the nuke deal. It's shocking. That was news that nobody was expecting to hear.
Iran lied?
It's funny because there's a lot of us that said that was probably going to be the case when that whole deal was made in the first place.
Looking forward to this phone call. Big, big fan of the show. Regular caller. Friend of ours, Don in Burnsville.
Hi, Don.
Hi, good morning.
Hi, hey, I haven't fired Sam, so I'm glad to see you've stayed true to your word and you're still listening.
Okay. I have to share my vast experience here in Minnesota because I don't think that companies like these have gone are no longer here doing business because of taxes.
Okay.
Companies like Honeywell, Control Data, Data 100, Univac, Grain Belt, Hams, Whirlpool, Ford, lots of the railroads, and Northwest Airlines, American Hoist and Derrick. These companies are no longer doing business here while 3M continues to thrive.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Okay. Go on.
Oh, yeah. I didn't want to tire you forever.
Are you going to have a point?
Do you know, you do realize that many, many businesses have specifically cited the tax climate as a reason why they've say moved headquarters to, I don't know, like Ireland.
No, that Northwest sent them to Atlanta.
Well, yeah, that's one.
I'm not talking about Northwest. Yeah.
Companies like Control Data, Data 100, and Univac are most of that business is done in California.
So your argument is that what you seem to be arguing is that businesses do not take the tax climate of one state over another into account when determining where they do business. Is that what you're saying?
No. That's not what I said. What I said, there are many factors.
Okay, right. It is true. There are many.
Taxes are one factor, but there are many, major many factor. Reasons why companies either go out of business or move out of state. So you can't just attribute taxes. 3M is a
but knowing that taxes are a major factor, Don. Why? Don, knowing, okay, we agree, we are on the same page, that taxes are a major factor. They're not the only factor, but they're a major factor that companies use. Knowing that, why wouldn't you try to make your state as competitive and as friendly as possible to invite more businesses in? Because even if you're a lower tax state, if you've got a large number of businesses, if you've got a thriving economy, the bottom line of your state is going to end up being healthier because you're going to have more people there with good paying jobs that aren't reliant on government services.
I think Mississippi is a good example of that. You don't see a lot of, they got low taxes, and you don't see a lot of companies moving to Mississippi.
You don't?
No.
You done a lot of Mississippi research?
They also don't have the population that Minneapolis and St. Paul have.
Mississippi?
It's
things like the University of Minnesota, the Mayo Clinic, and things like that our treatment of the elderly and things like that.
I don't think too many businesses care about treatment of the elderly.
Don, it still feels like you haven't landed the plane yet. What is your point?
this plane's made a lot.
You keep making land. These flybys, and I'm just, you're gonna put the plane on the ground. What's your point?
Well, one thing I didn't consider, I've worked for several of these companies, and maybe that's why.
You circled the airport again. Your plane is running out of fuel.
It's great to talk to you.
On to your next destination, Don. It's apparently we're going to land it on our show.
We're just going to fly right by.
I'm just going to circle around, annoy you for a bit, and then hope I got enough gas to
get
to the next place. Yeah. Dude.
I don't know.
Land it, crash it, do something.
Just anything.
All right. Here, I'll help.
Love you, Don.
Let's help Don out here. Got an article, CNBC. Thanks, Don. Economist Arthur Laffer and Stephen Moore are predicting a new mass exodus of wealth from New York and California because of the new tax law. That's right. In an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal headlined, "So Long, California, Sayonara, New York," Laffer and Moore, who have both advised President Donald Trump, say the new tax bill will cause a net 800,000 people to move out of California and New York in the next 3 years. The tax changes limit the deduction of state and local taxes to $10,000, so many high-earning taxpayers in high-tax states actually face a tax increase under the new tax code. Laffer and Moore say that the effective income tax rate, what people actually pay for high earners in California will jump from 8.5% to 13%. Wealthy Manhattanites will face a similar increase, they say. Those who make $10 million or more will see a potential tax hike of 50% or more, according to the analysts. Those hikes, they say, will cause an exodus of residents to move to lower or no income tax states like, you know, Mississippi, apparently.
Eric and Ramsey.
I was just saying that Don actually landed the plane beautifully.
He did? Okay.
Like, you didn't really give him the chance to say it out loud.
Well, okay, I tried to, and then he flew away.
he didn't fly away. He said that he had worked for a majority of those companies, and maybe that's why they're no longer here.
That's what Drew said.
I said that. Thanks,
Eric. You're calling in to make a joke, but Drew already made it. Good try. Try again next time.
Okay.
Thanks, Eric. Good to hear from you.
Why would you call in to say the same thing that Hall
started?
Oh,
he didn't hear me. Clearly didn't hear me.
Yeah, I just doubled down on how good Drew's joke was.
That was a funny moment of realization for me. You know what? I worked for a lot of these companies.
And then all of a sudden his plane flew away.
Yeah, that's a long list that he had.
I know, yeah.
It's a lot of turnover in Don's life, apparently.
It explains a lot.
Imagine Don's bosses. What's your point, man?
All right, we got enough time. Let's go here. So, editorial board, Star Tribune. Feds shouldn't interfere with the Metropolitan Council. Let Minnesotans decide whether and how to elect council members. This is a matter Minnesotans can and should decide for themselves. Drew, correct me if I'm wrong, but it's you, the 2nd District Republican U.S. Representative Jason Lewis, that is here, right?
Right. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, he is a Minnesotan, and he represents Minnesotans.
All right.
Minnesotans elected him. The 2nd District is indeed Minnesota.
Okay. Just wanted to make sure that was clear.
And for the Star Tribune, I'm trying to make this argument that Fed shouldn't interfere with the Metropolitan Council. The only reason we have a Metropolitan Council is because of federal interference.
Right.
We only have them to get those transportation dollars. Without it, it's not necessary. It's not required.
This is the Representative Jason Lewis attempting to apply a heavy thumb of the federal government to tip the scales in the long-running debate over the composition of the Met Council. Drew, and again, I'll do what the caller did, and I'll just double down on the comment that you just made in your point. But this tipping the scales, what do you think the federal government does with the Met Council when they toss millions upon millions of incentive dollars at them to move forward with these programs? That's not the federal government using the heavy thumb of their hand to tip the scales in their favor for the Met Council to move forward on these projects?
Yeah, the federal government is already incredibly intertwined, has its tentacles well into our regional planning, our transportation planning in the form of incentives and mandates and all of these things. So to try to make the argument that the federal government should just stay out of how we select who's on the Met Council, just let the governor pick who he wants, and we don't need to ask any questions. The governor is very wise, and he'll clearly make the right decision, is absolutely ridiculous and disingenuous. They are fighting back so hard, and it is very telling how hard they are fighting back against this idea of having some basic electoral accountability on the Met Council.
They quote the Met Council chairwoman at the very end of this piece. If Lewis's amendment would become law, the result would be uncertainty that could paralyze our regional transportation planning and funding efforts. And yet, the Star does, they do no examination of that statement. Nothing.
Nothing. They just repeat it.
They just repeat it.
And you talk about uncertainty. Jason Lewis made this point when he was on the show last week. What kind of uncertainty do you have when the staffing of the Met Council is up to the whims of whoever's governor?
Right.
You know, we're going to have an election in November. We're going to have a new governor in January. Are they so confident that someone who is like-minded of Governor Dayton is going to win the governor, is going to win the governor's race and either keep the Met Council in its current form or just appoint more like-minded people, that they are, that provides them with a level of certainty?
It says
shouldn't be.
Originally, reformers called for direct election of council members. In recent years, critics, situated primarily in outer ring suburbs, have argued instead of that, people elected to other local government posts, such as county commissioners, should also serve on the Met Council. At the legislature, a bill for that approach has GOP backing, but it's opposed by DFL Governor Mark Dayton, who vetoed the legislation, including that measure last year. Correct me if I'm wrong, Drew, but isn't one of the problems with the Met Council is that they've tried to spread beyond where they're supposed to be, like even going so far as to get their reach into like other states? Remember, they were trying to do that for a little while as well. So I think the people in the outer rings have a right to be critical of what the Met Council is trying to go into.
Yeah, the Met Council has expanded its influence, its reach, its power so far beyond what it was originally intended to. And you've got city after city and counties that are pushing back and saying, you know, that they don't want to be subject. You talk about uncertainty. You know, just imagine being on a city council and just wondering what kind of crap the Met Council is going to try to cram down your throats tomorrow.
So I will give the editorial board at the Star Tribune a little bit of credit for showing their hand in this, okay? Remember at the beginning of the piece, it talked about how Representative Jason Lewis stepped in to apply his heavy thumb, okay? This is a matter Minnesotans can and should decide for themselves.
Right.
And you correctly pointed out that second district. It's here. Towards the end of the piece, it says this. Instead, we, being the editorial board of the Star Tribune and their infinite wisdom, added that part. We favor instituting a staggered terms for council members and employing a panel of local officials as a screening committee to recommend council candidates to the governor. Okay, so ultimately, you just want to continue to have the governor decide.
Yeah.
But how is that different with your argument of Minnesotans can and should decide for themselves? Right now, we just want the governor to be able to still do it. We'll have a screening committee to recommend, and then he can still go and appoint them. If you're going to go that route, then why not make it real, sort of true to the Minnesotans who can go and decide who wants to be on that body and who gets to be on that body?
Yeah, and you know, the last sentence, say that's a lot of risk in order to short circuit Minnesota-based decision making. What is more Minnesota-based than elections? And actually having people that are accountable
right.
to constituencies and to the electorate for the decisions that they make.
Right.
And having representation. Constituent citizen representation. That's all we're asking for. Every other state does it this way. And they all work fine.
If the Met Council wants to continue their expansive reach, then yeah, they should be embracing this. Right? 651-989-5855. Fox News' Pete Hegseth joins us next.
Miss any of Justice and Drew? Download the podcast free at TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com.
I'm Chris Addison. Here's a look at the roads being brought to you by Compassion International. Just the one crash out there, eastbound 394, 169. Partially taking out the right lane ahead of that, slowing down as well, coming in from Highway 100 to downtown Minneapolis, northbound 35W. That is still...
You need to get someone to show you how Twitter works.
Yeah.
You'd have some fun with us.
Yeah, he needs... do we really want to encourage Don to get a Twitter account?
Yes.
Are you sure about that?
Yes, 100%.
It's just going to be one more person I have to mute.
Sure of anything. Don, get on Twitter.
It's going to have to be
use the hashtag TCNT.
I think he's still calling from like a corded phone. You call him in from a...
Rotary.
From a... Yeah.
See?
Sam, have you ever used a rotary phone?
I've seen one.
Okay.
I'm pretty sure. I don't think I've ever actually dialed with one, but I've seen one and played with the little spinny thing. But I don't think I've ever actually placed a call on it. It might have just been a toy. I don't know.
Really weird. Just having to finger the thing and to do the thing. It was very strange. It just was weird to put your finger in the hole and you had to finger it to call somebody up. Just...
Flag this
time. It's really odd.
It's 8:42. Get that drop. Okay. Pete Hegseth from Fox News. Good morning.
Good morning, guys. This plane is never going to land.
Welcome to Rotary Phone Talk.
Run off the clock. I'm with you. It's been a while since I dialed that rotary, but I should bring it back.
We'll work through a couple of different issues here. Let's talk about a big one that broke yesterday and get your thoughts on Benjamin Netanyahu and his press conference essentially in Israel yesterday, talking about how shocking you know, Iran lied over the nuke deal. Getting to sort of to a point on this, you know, we have this the next ratification date for it, May 12th coming up. Mike Pompeo has said, you know, some of the documents that they've seen are legitimate. I assume that the White House has probably been aware of this for a while. What do you think this means for the future of the deal?
Yeah, I'm sure Iran is yelling, it's all fake. None of it's true. I mean, you know, the propaganda is being hurled. It's fantastic. God bless Bibi Netanyahu. The boldness with which he understands the existential threat his country faces and the world faces. And when you've got the smoking gun, you've got the evidence that proves what we've all known. We know Iran's lying. We know they want a nuclear program. We know they're pursuing it anyway. We know their ballistic missiles are not just for television. They want to use them to deliver a nuke once they have the chance to miniaturize it. It's all lies. So once you have the proof and they can't deny it, even if they'll deny it publicly, they can't deny it behind the scenes, it does two things. One, it's an absolute no-brainer to scrap the Iran deal. It's fruit from a poison tree. Anything you get from it now is premised on a lie. It needs to go away and send that strong signal to Iran. We can handle whatever initial blowback they'll have. Remember when they said there'd be a big blowback by moving the embassy to Jerusalem? You know, that has not manifest either. Second, it's a huge signal to Kim Jong-un. We're going to know if you cheat. We're not going to let you cheat. John Bolton, Mike Pompeo, serious people. Either you make a real deal and it's verifiable or we're walking away. So they did their work. Service in pointing out what we all knew to be true, but with evidence.
You know, you go back to 2015, and that was one of the last sort of major altercations between Israel and Iran. You had Israel taking out one of the sons of one of the leaders of Hezbollah, in which case Hezbollah then went and retaliated and for a number of days launched missile strikes into Israel, into the countryside. Everybody kind of calmed down. They pulled back. I'm reading several different pieces of commentary this morning saying that we're in a more dangerous time now when it comes to the situation between Israel and Iran than we were back in 2015, that this war may no longer be fought via proxy, and that the battleground may actually be taking place in Syria. On top of that, we know that Israel allegedly went into Syria, bombed a couple of military sites where some Hezbollah militias were stationed. Is there any reading? Do you think it's proper to read into Benjamin Netanyahu releasing the details of these lies from Iran in the growing sort of conflict and tensions between the two?
Yes, I do. I think and Israel is increasingly more supported by the Sunni-Saudi side of things because they trust Israel more than they trust Iran, which is shocking when you think of the geopolitics of that region. Bibi Netanyahu, it's like from A Few Good Men. You know, he wakes up every morning just a few miles away from millions of people that want to eradicate him. I'm driving down 35E right now. I'm staring at St. Paul. I can tell you that if every single day inside St. Paul there were people who wanted to kill me and they were increasingly gathering the capability to do so, testing it, flaunting it, and they were religious fanatics who believe they go to heaven if they kill me, then I would be pulling out every single stop I have to prevent them from getting there. And Bibi Netanyahu, we can talk about the Iran deal all we want here in America, where we're comfy with the big oceans. But he has to think existentially about it. And I think his actions are a reflection of the fact that Iran is cheating on this deal. They do want nuclear weapons, and history has shown us what happens when dictators get the weapons they say they want and do what they say they're going to do. So it is a reflection of the fact that things are more serious. And when this Iran deal gets scrapped, Iran's going to feel justified to either race to a weapon or try to get back to the table. We'll see what happens there. But either way, Israel is most likely the country that will deal with it first and most powerfully.
What motivation would they have to get back to the table? I mean, they've already got tons of money out of this deal.
Time. Yeah. I mean, if they don't have a bomb yet or the type of technology they want yet, they will use the weak-kneed nature of the Europeans, who will beg the world to come back to the table. The UN will beg Trump to come back to the table. Okay, fine, we'll get a better deal. They may string that out while they accelerate their weapons program. That's the dangerous moment right there, because Israel's not going to let that happen, and we sure as heck shouldn't let them do it either. So it's like North Korea. Either you get them to the table, or the sooner you act, the better, because the longer you wait, the worse the consequences. And Kim Jong-un, you know, someone made this point. I think it's an important one. Kim Jong-un is one man who controls an entire country. Trump can negotiate with, he's used to that in business, right? The CEO makes the calls and the business moves. It just happens. So he's dealing with a fellow CEO where Kim Jong-un can make decisions on the spot. Whereas Iran and these other countries have, it's more deliberative. We know the Ayatollah is really in charge there. In Europe, you've got legislatures and other different contingencies. So the Iran deal is going to be messy, and Bibi knows it, and he's preparing for that.
Washington Times, according to a report, says Israel is ready to bomb Iran if necessary. Israeli defense officials have told their American and Russian counterparts that if Iranian-backed forces attack Israel from inside Syria, Jerusalem will not hold back from retaliating with direct strikes against Tehran or other targets in Iran. Does the scrapping of the nuke deal further clear the path for Israel to go and defend itself? Do you think is that standing in the way at all?
Yes, yes. I mean, the facade of the Iran deal stands in the way.
Gotcha.
Because of the so-called international consensus and the chorus that will come down on them. It still will happen, by the way. Thankfully, this White House has Israel's back, and I hope they act quickly if they determine that they absolutely must. And I think they would have to.
Switching gears, this article out of Reason. From yesterday, I'm talking about the VA's biggest problem isn't who's in charge. It's centralized government control with Trump's nominee, Ronny Jackson, out. And they talk about how to fix veterans' health care. We've talked about this in abundance with you. And they focus on here privatization of the VA in order to fix it. They do push back a bit on Trump wanting the VA to work more like Medicare, to have government write checks to private doctors and hospitals instead of government doctors and hospitals. Is there a combo here? A combo fix of the two? Do we need to go full privatization? And how much does whoever does get appointed to that position going to mean when it comes to the VA reform?
Well, it's going to be huge. You have to have a reformer. You have to have someone with political courage who can make an argument, who can go out into media and sell it. Because if you do what the president wants, which is not full privatization, but it is full choice, then you even forget the idea of privatization, which no one's arguing for except academically, because you have this existing system
right. That's
so big and so unwieldy that privatizing it is not feasible. What it is you can create real choice so that veterans can choose to go to the existing system or they go to an outside private provider, but there's no gatekeeper for them, and they get the best health care. You know, think of a guy down in Rochester who can't go to the Mayo Clinic, but he's got to schlep to the VA facility to get care that's nowhere near as good or couldn't be as good as the Mayo Clinic. That's what's at stake. Then the institution of the VA has to either fix itself to be competitive or reform itself to contain costs. And that's where you see irrational actual decisions being made about that government-run healthcare system that otherwise wants to grow no matter what. I mean, their answer is always more money and more hospitals. If you take that on, and President Trump wants to, whoever that VA secretary is going to face the government unions, it's going to face all the vets groups, all the guys in the funny hats. They're all going to come after him because they're existing special interest groups in Washington, D.C. And I'm not talking about the guys that go to the Legion or the VFW in Forest Lake, Minnesota, my hometown. I'm talking about their representatives in Washington who are obsessed with being liked and getting invited to cocktail parties and defending the VA system. The VA is going to come after you. The Democrats are really going to come after you. And then squishy Republicans are going to be worried about being called names, and so they're going to run for the hills too. This is just for choice. You better have a nominee who's prepared to make that case and doesn't back down, because guess what? The vets want it. The vets want that choice. And Washington knows if a veteran gets a choice, it challenges the entire existing system.
Yeah.
And that's how Washington perpetuates.
Well, you saw the nastiness with they came after Ronny Jackson. You know, I mean,
unbelievable. It was a metaphorical political assassination. It was an ambush. It was coordinated by John Tester and the Democrats and the media. CNN went wall to wall on anonymously sourced accusations that were never proved to be true. But the Secret Service has now come out and said that. Hold on.
Yep.
It has now said that those are not—they're not based on any fact at all. They were totally investigated and found to be untrue.
So to your point of, you know, having to withstand all those things and be able to fight, you know, the unions and the Democrats, you got to find someone who's willing to have, you know, character assassination attempts made at them through the confirmation process. Who the hell's going to do that?
You tell me.
Pete Hexa.
Whoever it is, better assume the opposite posture of Ronnie Jackson, and that's not to impugn Ronnie Jackson. He's not a political guy. He wasn't expecting it. He thought he did his confirmation hearing, his time in court, to defend himself. Instead, you know, the weasels came out with the anonymous sources, and they smeared him. Because all they care about is defeating and resisting Trump and defending the system. So whoever it is needs to be forward-leaning, go on the offense, call into the TV shows, get on the network, push back on whatever personal or professional accusations are going to be made. Because I don't care if you're as squeaky clean as can be. They're going to find a reason to hate you.
Yeah.
You better stand up for what you're trying to do.
I know this great guy, Drew. That's funny.
Pete Hegseth from Fox News. Thank you so much for joining.
Fox News. Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, you're very happy there. You're doing a wonderful job.
This is fantastic. This is a great gig. This is great.
We'll talk to you next week, buddy.
Right. Thanks for playing our reindeer games, dude. That's kind of fun. That kind of made me laugh. All right. Hey, before we close things out, I got an article here from Care 11. Sam.
Okay.
Sam, are you happy?
I am.
Generally speaking,
yes.
Right? I think we can all maybe be a little bit happier. Yeah. Right? A little bit happier. Okay. You know, universal pursuit of happiness, something that we all sort of strive for. According to experts in the latest research, that pursuit is increasingly unfulfilled, the pursuit of happiness.
I blame social media.
It is. Well, you know what? It happens to be on the list of the 11 steps to a happier life.
Ooh.
It is on here, right? They have some very specific suggestions. On how
11
you can,
steps to a happier
11 steps to a happier
from
life.
Care 11.
Yeah. And Drew, number one on the list.
How serendipitous.
Right? Limit your time on social media.
Yeah, man.
Yeah.
Social media is not good for you.
Yeah.
It is not good for your mental well-being.
Nope.
No. I'm doing it more and more. I'm setting the iPad down. I'm leaving it in my room. I'm setting the phone down. When I go to enjoy the other things that I enjoy, which is really just one thing sitting in front of my big TV, but be that as it may, you know, I put that stuff aside and I don't miss it. And like I said before, it's kind of like a little surprise when you go on return.
That's right. You'll have a little presents with you.
Yeah, exactly. Usually it's from you guys because you're the only ones to text me.
Or you'll have none and then you'll feel even worse.
Replace your Facebook time with face-to-face interactions with actual friends.
Right? Yes.
Yeah. It's easy when you don't have a lot of friends.
Spend time with people. Yeah. It's important.
Do I have to?
Try to work part-time and find a work BFF.
Aww. I have two.
I didn't know you and Dave Ryan were that close.
We're really close. Me, Dave, and Fallon. You know, we chill a lot. I don't know. I don't even.
No, I'm not happy anymore. What's the next step?
I barely even remember you two's names.
Focus on financial security.
Okay. And do my best.
Meditate every day.
Nah, I'm good.
Exercise.
Just like the time in the shower counts.
Yeah.
You know, when you're just like chilling.
That's meditating.
Okay.
Yeah.
Kind of run through your. Enjoy your day.
Physical activity. If you got a multi-storied house, you got stairs. It accounts for that.
No, it doesn't.
Just eat five serving of veggies a day.
Five. That
seems expensive.
Do my ranch flavored veggie straws count?
Nope.
But they're made from real vegetables.
Ranch flavored veggies. I love veggies. Nope.
There's actually zesty ranch.
Oh.
So they're basically Doritos.
Oh, you didn't say that.
Yeah, there's zesty ranch. Yeah, they're made from real vegetables and they're colored.
Where do you think the ranch comes from?
I don't know. Science?
I don't know and I don't care.
But the part that's delivering the ranch.
It's not like there's a ranch plant.
Is a vegetable. They're different colors like vegetables.
Oh, must be legit. I don't want
nobody. Everybody have a great day.
Good job. Let's do it again tomorrow.
We'll be here tomorrow from 6 to 9. Talking about things and stuff.
I'm Chris Addison. Here's a look at the roads being brought to you by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Couple crashes for eastbound 394. First one is at Hopkins Crossroad off to the right. Ahead of that, another one at 169 taking out the left lane. Looks like some slow traffic there. Cedar Avenue northbound, 63rd Avenue crash off to the right, and North 35W at Highway 13. Another accident on the right shoulder as well. 694 up in the north.